Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast for 6, 7 and 8 figure Amazon and e-commerce sellers, a part of the amazing FBA family. If you want to scale fast, target a 7 figure exit and enjoy the process, then keep listening. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-commerce Leader, co-hosted by myself, Michael Veazey, and Jason Miles, top 1% Shopify store owner and Udemy's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving e-commerce business, look for The E-commerce Leader on your favorite podcast app and subscribe today. Being ready for the holiday season is absolutely critical for your store's or Amazon success. That's why Capital Advance from today's sponsor, Payoneer, could be exactly what you need. Capital Advance gives you working capital to spend on anything that helps you grow your business. Use it to buy more inventory or more advertising or whatever you want. Offers feature a single fixed fee and a gradual settlement plan. Just go to payoneer.com/capital for a free consultation with a working capital expert today. Ladles and jelly spoons, boys and girls, welcome back to the 10K Collective, the place to be for 6, 7 and 8 figure Amazon sellers. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back an old friend of the show now, really, Will Churnland of Goat Consulting. Will's been a big name in the Amazon world for years, and at Goat Consulting, he specifically helps brands and manufacturers sell better on Amazon, which is, by the way, one of the more refreshingly simple taglines I've had for companies here. Will, warm welcome back to the show, my friend.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk a little bit about the future of Amazon and what we have ahead of us for the next 12 months or so.
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of us spend a lot of time down in the weeds and worrying about the tactical stuff that have a life expectancy of 2 or 3 months. And I really love to talk the bigger picture stuff. But to put it together for somebody like yourself who sees what's happening on the ground in reality rather than just sort of talking head style. So today we're going to talk about really your speciality, I think, which is getting companies that are going, that have sold business to business and getting to sell business to consumer, direct to consumer. So that B2B, B2C transition and all the pains that go with it. So tell us a bit about the sort of typical drivers that are happening right now. So we're recording this in November 2020. So obviously COVID has been a big driver of everything this year. We are refreshingly not going to even need to reference the US election. By the time you listen to this, you'll know which way it's gone. But we are going to talk about what's been driving companies in that direction. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's been really interesting the last probably 6 months or so. At my Amazon agency, our typical client is someone who's been selling their product for decades. They sell them in all sorts of different brick and mortar stores, or they manufacture it and sell it to brick and mortar stores, and then the distributor there sells it to brick and mortar stores and throughout there. And so traditionally, they are very mature brands that have their catalog down, they have their marketing down, their branding down, and like that last little 1% of business of them figuring out Amazon is where they struggle. And it tends to be either one day there's an e-commerce manager who runs their website, and one day they say, figure out Amazon, and they look into it for a little bit and go, I don't have the time for this, and get a budget to get it done. Or it's just people who want to outsource their Amazon department. So that's kind of the, when I say I'm talking to companies, that's kind of the profile you can think of who I'm talking to. But essentially, they are all looking to sell direct for one reason or another. A couple of examples I can give you. One is an example of a company that sells powdered milk. And a thing that was really interesting for them is that they are the manufacturer. They're used to selling to brick and mortar stores and such. But because they had the capability to merchant fulfill during March and April, when the fulfillment centers were starting to get shut down, they were able to do hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales, selling direct to the customer, merchant fulfilling, because basically no manufacturer out there can do merchant fulfillment once in two orders. And so that's kind of one interesting example of a company kind of getting ahead of the curve. Another company I can tell you about is a company I talked to that sold cold brew coffee. And they said to Costco and Starbucks, and they're a big distributor for them, and they manufacture the actual containers. And again, these brick and mortar stores were not placing the purchase orders that they traditionally were, because they're either going out of business or shut down because of COVID. And that these manufacturers saying, we need to make up this revenue one way or another. We've toyed around the idea of us selling direct on Amazon for the last 5 years or so, But now looks like the writing's on the wall. Now's the time to do it. We need to look into it. We need to Google an Amazon expert or an Amazon consultant to walk us through this. And then I'm kind of just sitting there at the top of the Google results. So it's been really interesting. Basically, every single company I've talked to, I'd say almost 90% of the companies I've talked to in the last 6 months are kind of thing where they've never sold directly to the customer in their life, and that they're looking to kind of rip that Band-Aid off for the first time in their multi-decade kind of legacy.
Very interesting. So, I mean, obviously we've talked before and you've been working with your agency for quite a while now, but what's interesting is that the move has gone from a nice to have or a maybe one day or a future expansion plan that keeps getting pushed to one side, especially when things get busy, to a we have to do this right now necessity, which I think is what's happened across the board, right? My mother is in her 70s and she's ordered once in her entire life from online before this year, I think. And this year she's probably ordered 30 times. I mean, it's necessity suddenly changing the game, right? But accelerating things in a violent way. And that's a very interesting kind of particular piece of the market that doesn't get discussed that often. So what are the common issues that people hit? So let's talk macro to micro. Obviously, you're an Amazon expert and we focus on Amazon here, but let's try and get outside the Amazon echo chamber, where you, in your wonderful phrase, which I use a lot. I should pay you some royalties for that phrase. But it's very dangerous to think of things that are special to a particular platform, because I think then we lose business model thinking, which I believe is very important. So what are the macro issues with changing from selling direct, you know, from to another distributor or any other middleman to direct to consumer?
A lot of these companies don't have like a returns department, if you think of it that way, or you even think of someone like Clorox bleach. You can't go to Clorox.com and buy a liter of bleach. And most of these manufacturers don't have a way to ship ones and twos to customers. And so if they don't have a way to ship ones and twos, it's only a mini step up for them not to have the capabilities to do fulfillment by Amazon. So we work with a candy bar brand that I know they basically do a manufacturing run and put it straight onto the pallets and send it into FBA. And so every time you want to replenish an FBA order, you also need to do like a serial code production run. And so stuff like that is with these kind of older, more legacy businesses, they're either because they have stuff that's shelf stable or they're just not willing to keep, say, 3 to 6 months in stock on hand at all times and send in inventory and replenish it that way. And so that's been kind of a barrier for a lot of these manufacturers dealing with. And then also the idea that they're used to, like Vendor Central style, they're used to getting a purchase order, knowing it's going to be paid in 15 to 30 days, shipping out that purchase order when they can, and then getting another purchase order and doing it again, and attaching that little purchase order to the pallet, having it sent out, and no problem. And the idea of them building inventory that's not already sold from a purchase order, and then holding that inventory, and then sending it to a different location where they don't know where it is, that it might get moved around, and it's still not sold yet. It's just moving around in other people's warehouses. And so these manufacturers have to like make fake warehouses within their pre-existing inventory management systems, because they're not Amazon inventory management systems like we're used to. They're kind of more old school B2B ones. So to make other, and then decide when the sale actually happens in each warehouse and when they're going to reconcile that sale. And so there's a lot of these weird, complicated things that when you're creating an Amazon business from scratch and you're just doing the Amazon yourself, you can do it any way you want to. And you just take the path of least resistance, since there's so much like $20, $30 a month cloud software out there to help you with taxes, help you with inventory, help you with that. And you kind of just make this Frankenstein of cheapo Amazon software for $200 and it works great. Now, imagine you come to this company that has these great products that are selling awesome on Amazon, there's great margin, but their inventory management system is from 1998. We dealt with one company in the past that it was actually an inventory management system for lumber, like 2x4s and stuff, and that they rewired it so that they could use it for FBA inventory. And so when you type stuff in, it always wants like your lumber measurements for each SKU and stuff like that, and you just put 00. And so like this weird stuff like that, where it's like you have to use these legacy systems that they've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars for training and stuff and try to get them to work around for Amazon. And so that's been kind of the one interesting issue, is that all these manufacturers would love to just be able to flip a switch and sell directly on Amazon. And for everyone who's listening to this, and me and Michael here, we think just from a 1,000-foot point of view, they should just be able to flip a switch and be like, well, you got it in the store. Like, I don't know. Like, you got any warehouse, just like create a fulfillment. I don't know. But it's not that simple. It's a lot more complicated. And it's been very interesting working with all these different businesses who have all these different types of business models and figuring out how Amazon may work best for their specific model.
That's very interesting. So what they've got, they've sort of hardwired, I suppose, as you said, for startups, the lovely thing is everything's on the cloud. That's now a standardized way of operating, which was never a thing, right? I guess even the internet was not really, if you go back far enough. I mean, I was showing my age now. I graduated from university having used the internet for nothing, really, in the late 90s, because it was just a thing. And I guess if your sisters were hardwired, then I could see it comes from a different world. So the obvious question for me, I suppose I'm getting a bit obsessed with a particular concept and seeing it everywhere. But one of the things that strikes me is that sounds like a sunk cost in Seth Godin's view of the world. What are your conversations like with the manufacturers? Is it possible for them to just start to, when they really get serious with B2C, when they're a bit further into the curve of adapting this new way of living, if you like, new way of working, is it possible to just abandon those old systems, or is it just really too hardwired? They wouldn't be able to function without those.
Coming from working with my family's 80-year-old manufacturing business, so just kind of seeing what the culture's like and stuff, it's got to be slow and gradual. You're not just going to be able to do it overnight. And so, like, currently, say a company, it's very common in the US, especially for a company to have distributors who control territories. Territories is a big word you hear a lot with dealing with these companies. And back in the day, before the internet, it made sense. I have the Northeast, I have the Northwest, and they'd have their specific states that they can sell in. They kind of have a monopoly over these states for this specific category of products. Well, now that people just buy this stuff on Amazon, it doesn't make any sense for these people to have their territories. But at the same time, they do, these reps tend to make pretty decent money because they get a percentage of every sale and that type of thing. So what you'd want to do in a perfect world is take these reps and the money you're spending on them and kind of slowly wean off them one by one and replace that money with money spent on like an advertising agency and a branding agency and a D2C Shopify e-commerce agency and that kind of stuff. So then you can go, okay, this guy used to add value because he was able to talk to my 40 customers in the Pacific Northwest and make sure that if they ever had an order, he would replenish it. Now, how do we provide as much value to those customers, but over the internet? Is it really awesome YouTube videos describing the products? Is it always having in stock and fast shipping to our customers? Is it being able to be really good with returns and warranties? Where were they actually providing value, and how can we do like the internet equivalent of that?
So interesting. So I guess it's a hard transition. And when you put it that way, I guess the word territory, when you say the word territory, I mean, people are,
it sounds silly.
Territorial. No, not at all. I was just thinking, I mean, it sounds very kind of, what's the word, particularly for Americans, I think. Now I'm exhibiting all my prejudices today, but I think like male American humans are probably territorial animals to the nth degree. And I always think a territory kind of makes me think about people sort of standing at each other going, arr, and beating their chest. But joking aside, there is something about possessiveness, isn't there? There's an ownership that people take of a sort of sales area or a particular division that I guess that's a psychological transition that is actually going to be really difficult, right? I mean, joking apart, it does sound like there's a lot of an unpicking of people grabbing things and owning them and feeling that they're their thing and they're going to defend it at all costs. And you've got to just kind of let go of the hands and just persuade them to go elsewhere. How does that process kind of pan out in real life?
It's really kind of describing from the, say, the scrap piece of metal to the end customer who opens it in their bedroom. Where is the value actually added? So it's like the value is added when the metal's bent for the specific fan or whatever you want to sell. I'll use fans as an example because I know that. So the fans, there's value added by finding the right motor in China that's the most reliable and testing it over time and making sure that it's tested before it's installed in the product. And then there's value in getting customer awareness and getting it in the customer's hands. Now, that awareness is just so much better on like Google ads and Amazon ads than having a dude or woman in the Northwest Territory. They're not going to buy a bunch of billboards for you. They're not going to go just door to door grinding, trying to figure out who wants to buy your product. Traditionally, not to like begrudging the reps, but it works a lot kind of like almost like insurance reps too, where they get their territory, they get all their connections, and then they can kind of just sit on their hands and wait for orders to come in because they've made the connections over the last couple of decades and they know who their guy they buy their product from is, and that's just how it works. And they're rarely like hustling to get new accounts and stuff like that. So they're not really adding awareness. They are adding some value of like having the product on the shelf and letting customers touch it and look at it and answering questions and stuff like that. But as people become more introverted and want to just do research on YouTube and that type of thing, it's going to become less and less helpful that they can provide value there. And so you really kind of look at it and go, okay, region by region, which one of these is actually providing value, or territory by territory, which one is actually providing value? What value are they providing? What even like, what age are they? Are they a rep who's 59 years old? It's like, all right, well then just give them like another year or whatever. If the rep is 24 years old, maybe find a way to get them involved with your Amazon business, or try to find a way to get them within your business to help you that way kind of thing, and try to decide kind of how much do they want to be a team player, or how much were they just making a quick buck off you, and how much value can you guys add working together?
I think there's a kind of violent transition, particularly as you reference, like sort of the older somebody is, the more like they are making a transition as a consumer. Like my mother's the typical example, from pretty much technophobe. I mean, she owns actually a nicer Mac than I do, and an iPad, but like trying to get her to turn it on is a bit of a mission. And suddenly she's having a culture shock, if you like. And also these guys that maybe at a certain age that they're going, oh, I don't understand this Google thing. I just want to go and shake somebody's hand, have a coffee and say, thanks, Bob. And that's a completely violent different skill set, right? Even though the value they're adding to the business may be aiming in the same kind of direction. This is very, very interesting. I suppose
we can't, yeah. We also can't help but think in terms of systems and scaling.
Yes, right.
Because we're internet native. And then we also think in terms of like ACOS and types of how, if I spend $1 on a billboard, I need to know exactly how many sales I got back. This impression thing is just not going to cut it type of thing. And so it's this idea of us having data to back everything up, us knowing exactly where every dollar actually goes nowadays. And we want to find how do we find a good kind of economy of scale in a place where we know that we're profitable, and how do we put more coal in that fire and make it bigger type of thing. And that doesn't work where it's like, not like you can just be like, well, this rep worked great, we're just going to hire another 100 reps because there's only so many people and there's only so much time in the day type of thing. And so it's an interesting thing of going from the mindset of relationships to scaling.
Yeah, I think you just put your finger on it. Go from relationships to systems and scaling systems. And yeah, that you're right. It's a completely different mindset. And also, I think we've had a couple of sort of legacy type businesses come through the masterminds, one of whom has completely ditched their old way of operating and they're direct to consumer 100%. And they've just, you know, broken through 8 figures a year, or quite like left that very far behind them now. But other people that you can see them going halfway through this process that those guys are several years ahead of. And it really is a culture shock. I mean, he's sitting there going, well, I don't get this. Because I guess if you do something for decades, you just get into the habit of it, and you don't have to examine from an abstract point of view, from the business model thinking. Again, it's what I'm always obsessed with these days. It's like, okay, let's take the concrete, make it abstract, look at what the function of it is, and then see if we can recreate that in a more efficient way, right? As you say, systems thinking, which is really interests me. Some people naturally think that way. Most people don't. So how do you help your clients to sort of transition, if you like, mentally? Obviously there's concrete things that you take them through, but do you sort of try and work with them to become more systems oriented? And if so, how do you do that?
In general, it's just kind of when we first ask them like their KPIs, it's always interesting to see what they think compared to what we would think. And one way we do that is actually we have a huge Google Forms that we've created that we have customers fill out when we onboard them, of how many impressions would you want? How important is getting this product in front of customers? How important is this one from 1 to 10? So that we can really have a perfect kind of playbook of, okay, so when we come back to you in a week and we go, hey, ACOS is 10%, just like you said, but we've already spent $1,000 this month. We need another $1,000. We can go back to the playbook and go, look, you said you would be willing to spend this much money up to this percentage point. Because what they don't like in these traditional organizations is a dynamic advertising budget. That makes them scared. Even if the economics are right, that still makes them scared. They don't like that. They really, really want to be able to go, okay, after, like, we're working with a company, say we sign them tomorrow. their main goal, one of their main goals would be figure out advertising over the next 2 months so that by January 1st, you can tell us a static dollar amount that we should spend for 2021. That's really important to them. And that for every normal FBA seller, that's the last thing they actually care about. And so it's kind of adjusting their mindset of, no, but if we can spend a dollar to make $10, why wouldn't we just do more of that? And they go, well, we can't take more from the marketing budget team. And if we actually could do that many sales, then the sales team's going to be mad because they're not going to hit their numbers because you're cannibalizing their sales. Like, what? But it's more profitable though. And it's like, well, yeah, but, and so it's like really knowing personality types of who we're working with on the team, how much they're on our side versus like the business's side. How do the systems work within that business? How do we not like step on any toes? And at the same time, I try to kind of use, as I've seen you like smirk a couple times, like a tiny bit of a humor and kind of like almost like know-it-allness to kind of get them to relax a little bit and be like, hey, I'm coming in here to change things, but like, I'm not here to ruin your life or anything like that. I just have some decent ideas.
I think it really is a culture shock, right? I mean, because we talked about this before, but somehow a lot of this stuff, you'll make it very concrete. I mean, and because it's not a world that I've worked in. I've had the fortune or the misfortune not to really work in big corporates or even medium-sized corporates very much. I've done the odd bits, but I guess that budget sort of allocation thinking is so completely different to most. I guess now the word digitally native makes sense to me because I've spoken a lot to the guys at Global Wired Advisors who are mergers and acquisition specialists, and they just help people. They help basically broker deals between Amazon and e-commerce business owners and SaaS business owners and private equity. And obviously the private equity world and investors look at things from a completely different lens to the operation focused managers that we mostly are. But then the word digitally native always sounded very pretentious to be like, well, of course, everything's digital, isn't it? But now I understand that there's a real world outside where people have a very fixed way of looking at things that's really, really different. I'm like, the idea of not spending more money or having a fixed ad budget for 2021, I'm like, I suppose I'm smirking at the sheer impossibility of like, you'd have to be a genius to really nail the optimum ad spend for a particular business in such a dynamic environment as we're in now, right? So how do you even deal with that question?
Well, I was about to say, imagine they put me in this position all the time. Imagine they spent $5,000 in the month of November and did a 20% ACOS. And then we spent $5,000 in the month of December and had a 15% ACOS because we obviously knew a little bit more and had a better idea of what we were up to. So then they go, all right, how much should we spend on advertising for 2021? And I literally just freeze up because I'm like, I don't know. You tell me, like, how much money do you guys have? How aggressive do you want to be? What's our plan here? Are we trying to be offensive, defensive? What are we trying to do here? And so that's where that kind of survey comes into play, because I don't have to ask them all those questions. They kind of have answered them for me without me asking them directly. And so that kind of becomes a benefit. But no, we've literally gotten to the point where we're working with like a publicly traded company, and we had like a $250,000 ad budget for the year. And we spent it like by mid-February at like a 4% ACOS, because they sell very expensive, large things. And we had to like go to the board of directors and like plead our case to get more budget for the advertising for the year. And that's just like crazy talk for if you heard someone was doing 3% ACOS and they were spending that kind of money, you're like, well, what are we waiting for type of thing? So yeah, it's a really interesting thing to try to balance when clients all the time say, how much should I spend on advertising? Because we also had a company that spent, I believe it was like $500,000 in advertising their first month of them being on Amazon. And they did like $344,000 revenue their first month. So it was, they're a startup, they're venture backed. They don't mind that it's 120% ACOS because now all of their products have 30 sales. All of them have 5 reviews each. And it's only a month in and they're already at $250,000 a month now in sales, kind of thing. And when other companies go, hey, we want to be to $250,000 in sales in 3 weeks or in 3 months, it's like, well, we've done it before, but we've spent $100,000 in advertising. And they go, well, we don't have the budget for that. And so it's like, it's all this back and forth, basically us measuring our patients, figuring out what their advertising budgets are, and then figuring out what's going to make them happy and look good to their boss. Because that's part of the thing too, is that they're always like, I need these metrics up so then I look good. So then how do we scratch their back too? And so we try to do our best of just doing what's best for the actual business while fitting within their kind of constraints of their bureaucracy.
So fascinating. It's a much more, I mean, it sounds, I'm a strange kind of person that the more complex something is, the more I'm interested in it, really. I guess it's one of the reasons why I went into digitally native business, as they put it. But it sounds like the dynamics at play, the human dynamics, as well as the systems dynamics, are quite interesting. And that's got to be an art more than the science, right? That you're learning how to sort of not step on toes. I guess the fact that you come from a business background where your parents owned a business that made this painful transaction, and you and your brother, I know, did a lot of that work, that I guess you've been there yourself. Personally, and I suppose it helps. So this is a
it's luckily for us, it is the one kind of special sauce you can actually add to like our Amazon consulting against like our competitors, where there's other people who have like a team in the Philippines or this or that, or they have a couple ex-Amazon people, and it's like it's just hard for them to add value in those other kind of more human ways that aren't as easily measured.
Yeah, and to be honest, from what our discussion today has been fascinating, because most of it hasn't really been around systems. I mean, obviously, there are some things where, well, I guess a lot of us know the traditional Amazon systems and ways of adding value, right? But what it strikes me is it's about the management of people's thinking and people's feelings. I guess people's identities as a regional rep, is that threatened? Is it going to take my territory away from me? That sounds like, to any higher order primate, including humans, a very threatening thing, and they're going to defend your territory. And so there are all sorts of subtle human dynamics that you sounds like you're managing more than actually, you know, they've got established businesses, they've got good products. If they're doing, you know, 4% ACOS, that there's obviously not a problem from the point of view of it working as a product. The thing that we normally, I suppose, as digitally native business owners, if you like, obsess about is my product to market match good? You know, does the economics of advertising produce a positive return and so forth? They have completely different concerns. So that's really, really interesting. Could you summarize then what you think that, for anyone listening who's in that kind of business or halfway sort of transitioning between the pure B2B to B2C through Amazon or anywhere else, what would you say are your sort of takeaways, that the things that they should work on to get the best wins?
Yeah, I think they really need to have like a 6-month plan, like an 18-month plan, and like a 5-year plan with Amazon. Because some of them just try to pretend like it's going to go away or something like that, or it's like not here to stay. And so it's like, okay, what's your 6-month plan? Our 6-month plan is doing all the research we can to see where we fit in the marketplace, how much sales using Jungle Scout or Viral Launch or something, how much sales are done in my category, how much can I project that I can add value type of thing. And next 6 months is at least planning to kind of do something moving forward. In the next 12 months, you'd hope, or 18 months, that you'd hope that they actually can like get on Amazon. They can actually start selling, they can actually start marketing and those types of things, where 6 years from now, they're running it all internally and hopefully 50% of their revenue is through Amazon and it's running smoothly. But that first, say, 6 month is internal planning. The next 12 months after that would be actually getting on Amazon and hiring an agency like mine, getting something going and getting the ball rolling, with the hope that by 2025, everything is rolling as smooth as possible. It's a substantial part of your business and that the culture is shifted by then.
That sounds really good. And having a short-term, medium-term, long-term plan is probably something that's not unnatural to those guys in the corporate world. And the final thing I would say, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about this, is there's actually a lot of structure there. Now, that can seem a barrier. I guess it is a barrier to changing from B2B to B2C type models. And I guess also, let's not forget, from offline to online, that's also a huge challenge, right? But it strikes me also there's something we can learn from that very structured approach, because most smaller business owners, obviously, they have a small business, they can be nimble, but they have a bit of a lack of structure and a lack of planning. So what would you say are the sort of, just to end it on a more positive note, for these poor legacy companies we've been beating up for so long, that people who are earlier in developing a business and they started off digitally, what could we learn from those guys? What are the sort of main takeaways for those people?
Yeah, I kind of gave honestly a talk about this a couple years ago at an Amazon conference about kind of like, what are the things you can do that don't scale? And what are the things that you can do that big guys can't do? And so it's really kind of making a list of, okay, what can the big guys do? Well, they can always keep the product in stock because they have tons of inventory of, say, Clorox. But what they can't do is come out with a 8-ounce size bottle instead of a 12-ounce size bottle, because that's going to take them 18 months of R&D to figure that out. So if I figure out that I can make a different size in them, maybe I can have a 4-ounce bottle of bleach, an 8-ounce bottle of bleach, and a 28-ounce bottle of bleach, and all they can do is 12-ounce, and I can cannibalize 75% of the sales. And so it's like always trying to figure out the like bundles, this, that, all these different things that like these big, slow moving corporations aren't going to be able to launch products within 3-6 months where you definitely can. And so take advantage of you being small and nimble and basically like almost like guerrilla warfare style where they got the big tanks, they got the jets, they got everything. You're the guy hiding in the trees with the booby traps, trying just to collect every ounce of cash you can along the way until you've done it in a systemized enough way that you're just like them and you're actually just another business kind of thing. But in the meantime, you just got to be scrappy because you know they have the extra firepower and that they can do things that take dollar amounts. And so you need to do stuff that's more unscalable and stuff that takes more brains.
Perfect. That's a great way of ending it. I like that. They do stuff that take big dollar amounts. So we got to do stuff that takes more brains. That's excellent bit of advice. Well, look, Will, it's been a very, very interesting sort of high level overview of this whole B2B to B2C transition. And doubtless we'll revisit this at some point, but that's been fascinating stuff. So what we got coming up next is the big question of fulfillment. We've been so used to FBA being able to handle anything we can throw it, and now it's got its growing pains. So we'll be talking about that in the next episode. But for now, Will, many, many thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the 10K Collective podcast, part of the family of amazing FBA podcasts. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-Commerce Leader. The podcast is hosted by yours truly and Jason Miles, multi-million dollar Shopify owner and Unami's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be, it's got your name on it. For free guides and mini courses on many topics, go to www.theecommerceleader.com.